from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, President Barack Obama rolled out his 2011 $3.8 trillion budget proposal for congressional approval yesterday. Much of what is in the proposal was highlighted in his State of the Union speech as priorities of his administration, and these are put into specific numbers in the budget, which was set before the largely Democratic Congress. We'll discuss the overall proposal and the specifics in the hour ahead, including what it would likely mean for the state of California and whether or not it has any real likelihood of making it through Congress, despite the Democratic majority. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, President Obama presented to the Congress his $3.8 trillion budget proposal for the fiscal year of 2011. The proposal includes more taxes on the wealthy, oil and gas companies and banks, deficit cutting, a job creation program, more money for education as well as for scientific research and defense programs, and a three-year spending freeze on everything except military and veteran spending, homeland security, Social Security, and Medicare. Also included in the Obama administration budget proposal is tax relief for the middle class and small businesses and the proposed overhaul of health care that has recently faced serious setbacks. In this Forum Hour, we look at the president's plan, its likelihood of passage through the Congress, and what is apt to mean for California. Joining us from Washington is Carolyn Lockhead, who is Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. And good morning, Carolyn Lockhead.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jean Ross with us, who is with us from the state capitol. She's executive director of the California Budget Project, public policy research group based in Sacramento. And welcome, Jean Ross.
Always a pleasure.
Glad to have you. And David Henderson is here with us this morning as well, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And welcome, David Henderson.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you all aboard. Carolyn Lockhead, let me begin with you, if I may. The centerpiece of this is, the attempt to rein in the massive federal budget deficits and $100 billion to attack unemployment. I'm wondering what your general sense is of how it's being received in Washington, particularly since we have Mitch McConnell and the GOP saying it's more of the same, more spending, more taxes, and more debt.
Well, the interesting thing is it's really not a whole lot different in structure from his first budget last year. And yes, it's meeting a wall of Republican opposition. And interestingly enough, among Democrats, there's resistance to the spending freeze, which is really quite minor. More window dressing than anything to sort of show a feint toward fiscal responsibility. And the list of programs he'd like to trim are meeting the usual resistance from the Senate Agriculture Committee, for example, doesn't want farm subsidies touched. The oil and gas industry doesn't want its tax subsidies cut. It's the usual, the business as usual, really, here in Washington.
And business as usual means what as far as the chances of this budget proposal getting through, even to some degree as it exists now?
Well, I think the jobs program has a good chance because it's popular. What's unpopular with both parties is any serious effort at deficit reduction. The deficits have reached a point where budget analysts across the board are flashing red warning lights that this is a serious problem as far as the U.S. economy goes.
Is there concern about this being the largest Pentagon budget, which I believe, not including the $160 billion for the war efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan, is the biggest we've seen since, what, World War II?
Yes, that's huge. It incorporates some of the costs of the war in Afghanistan, troop increases. There's some move by Secretary Gates to take a harder look at some of the weapons programs. But yes, everything is on pretty much the same course.
And what is within the president's own party? I mean, he certainly still has a majority, but you indicated that there's resistance not only to the freeze, but to the concern about ending or reducing these crop subsidies. What other kind of resistance?
Well, there's resistance even to, this is the more interesting thing, the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy. probably, you know, that's sort of been the mantra of the Democratic Party. It's that we would roll back the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy. That's probably likely to succeed in the House, but there are rumblings in the Senate that this is the wrong time to raise taxes, that the upper brackets affect small business, that we shouldn't be doing this before the recovery is in place. So whether or not that gets through the Senate is another question. That, those Bush tax cuts expire this year and next, so they have to be dealt with.
What about the taxes on the oil companies?
Again, meeting heavy resistance. You know, that's they're a very strong lobby here, and it's dubious as to whether or not any of those tax subsidies will be eliminated.
I'm also struck by the fact that the Obama administration put in the overhaul of health care into this budget, as if, to some extent, things are just going to progress or move forward.
Right. That is another. I mean, he basically, the administration has been and still is counting on health care to attack the long-term structural deficits. It's perfectly logical. That's where the deficits are being driven by excess health care spending, especially Medicare and Medicaid. But, you know, plugging that into the budget sort of ignores the fact that it has reached an impasse in Congress. It's looking increasingly unlikely, like as if that anything would be done this year, although they, House Speaker Pelosi insists that they will pass something. But it's, there's no path forward at this point.
We're talking with Carolyn Lockett, who's Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle and who joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. This is a budget which the president's people are saying puts the nation on a fiscally sustainable path, but they're still blaming the deficits on President Bush. When are they going to be able to perhaps, well, I guess from the perspective of the Republicans, assume more responsibility for deficits themselves?
Well, at some point, that you know, the thing is, Obama inherited a giant mess. There's no question about that. But he's been talking deficit reduction. In fact, the White House website says this is a new era of responsibility. Yet they're basically putting all their eggs in health care reform, which we already talked about, and then this idea of a deficit commission, which would postpone any difficult decisions until after the midterm elections. Even then, this commission, because it's simply done by executive order, will have no teeth in Congress, can't force Congress to do anything. And all those hard decisions about what spending to cut and what taxes to raise are essentially being postponed for another year.
And we're going to see at this point months of debate, obviously.
Of course. And everything right now is going to be put on hold this year. Every other year is an election year. So if you don't get it done when it's not an election year, every other year, it doesn't seem to get done at all.
Any predictions at this point how this is going to play out?
At some point, this administration is being caught in the deficit trap that budget analysts have been talking about for 20 years, where the entitlement program starts squeezing everything else in the budget so that there's no latitude left to do domestic policy. Well, that's the point where we have finally reached, and I suspect that the first-year stimulus basically shot all the arrows in the administration's quiver as far as domestic policy goes. And from here on out, it's going to be a very hard slog to get new programs enacted.
There are 120 programs in this budget that are either going to be cut or killed, but as far as entitlements, there's really not much to reduce them.
No, and they're planning on health care reform. And then the irony is the health care reform bills that passed the House and Senate are pretty weak on cost containment.
Carolyn Lockhead, again, is Washington correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Sacramento now and talk with Gene Ross, who is executive director of the California Budget Project. Again, they're a public policy research group based in Sacramento. And Gene, we know the governor went sort of with his hands out. As far as this budget, he gets some money for California, but certainly not what he asked for.
There's some good news for California in the federal budget and some could be better news. I think the good news is the extension of some of the provisions that were in the Federal Recovery Act from last year, a continued increase in the federal government share of Medicaid, Medi-Cal here in California, that has the impact of freeing up state dollars that can be used to balance the budget. Some money for welfare programs, the so-called TANF block grant, actually some interesting improvements in that program that would provide 100% federal funding for supported work programs, basically getting people to work, paying for jobs for those individuals. What the president didn't propose, and I think appropriately so, is some of the special treatment that the governor asked for. So I think what's in the budget, what's good for California, is that continued funding for economic recovery. I think there's more that could be done, should be done. I think I'd take a little bit, on the one hand, more optimistic view than I think Carolyn on some of this. And I think the economic analysis of the budget, not quite as uniform as she might suggest. I think there are a number of leading economists that are concerned that the president is taking away the punch bowl just as the party gets going or before it gets going, as the old saying goes, that cutting back on some of these critical programs could leave unemployment at unacceptably high levels, could, you know, potentially endanger a fairly fragile economic recovery. I think that's one of the things that will be debated over the next several years. So some good news, more money for extended unemployment insurance benefits. That's critical here in California, where we still have unemployment rates in excess of 12%. Some money for food stamp benefits, which if you model out in economic terms, has the biggest bang for the buck in terms of federal dollar impact on local economies. That's great news for California. And hopefully, as the budget moves through Congress, we'll see more money moving to states in order to keep this recovery going.
I was noticing that Senator Feinstein's office put out essentially a statement that says that this will be of enormous help to California. She's perhaps even more optimistic than you are, citing the jobs bill and the tax relief for the middle class, but also such things as improving the water infrastructure because of money for CalFed. There's about $40 million going there. And helping rail in the state because over $6 billion going into the infrastructure, even mentioning food safety. From the perspective of Senator Feinstein, everything looks really roses here almost as far as California.
Again, I think there is a lot of good news for California, for states in general. I think there's room for a little bit more good news potentially. But I think, again, it is a budget that looks to the fact that we are still hopefully coming out of an economic downturn, but the recovery is quite fragile. So there is money for states, I think some fairly well-targeted money for states. There's some fairly wonky stuff in there that I think actually will be good for California. One of the things the president's proposing to help balance the budget for the long term is some tax compliance, closing the tax gap, making sure that people who owe taxes actually pay those taxes.
Because so that could bring in more revenue, really, couldn't it?
More money to the federal government, but because of the way the state and federal tax systems fit together, that could actually boost revenues here in California. So I think we are still trying to understand how everything will work. But there is a lot of good news for California.
What about the reducing of cooperative subsidies for wealthy farmers? Is this going to have an effect, as you see it, on California agriculture?
I think it will have less of an impact on California if it's actually enacted. And again, I think this is always an area that's highly controversial in Congress because most of those subsidies go to the grain belt, the types of crops that are produced primarily here in California. I think Californians, at least have claimed over the years, haven't received their proportionate share of some of those subsidies. So I think certainly if we are looking to address the deficit, that is a place that ought to be on the table. And back to the issue of health reform, and I think, again, this gets to how do you address the deficits long term? It's there because health programs, health spending is a primary driver of shortfalls in the future. And the package that has been moving through Congress, both the Senate bill, House bill, would reduce federal health spending over time. Maybe not quite as much as some might like it to be, but you have a number of economists that say the deficit problem really is a health care problem. And unless we begin to get health care costs under control, we'll never be able to address that federal shortfall.
Well, this budget as presently constituted would mean continuation of COBRA and children's health programs, would not?
And child nutrition programs. Yeah. So again, you know, some very good news there. The COBRA subsidies that were done last February as part of the recovery package, a tremendous benefit to people who have lost their job, lost their health coverage, need a bridge until the job market improves. Continuation of some of the increased tax programs for low-income working families, one-time $250 economic recovery package, extension, making work pay tax credit through 2011. Again, these are both initiatives that have been very good news for California. So I'm probably a little bit more in Senator Feinstein's camp on this one.
Dean Ross, again, is Executive Director of the California Budget Project, and David Henderson is a research fellow at Hoover Stanford, Associate Professor of Economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And David Henderson, so much of this budget, I mean, as it's, again, as it presently exists and is being turned over to the Congress, depends really, the key to it, I guess you could argue as an economist, it depends on how much of a recovery we're going to see.
That's true. The reason that tax revenues are so low as a percent of GDP is that the recession's on, and so when you have a boom, revenues recover more quickly than GDP does because higher income people pay a higher percent of additional dollars in income, and lower income people pay a higher percent of additional dollars in income as they move into higher brackets. And so, yes, that's true.
Well, I was reading Brad DeLong, who I suppose as an economist maybe sees through different lenses than you do, but he said this is a short-term medication as far as the deficit, and as opposed to maybe strengthening the recovery and securing lasting fiscal health.
Well, I don't agree with him on medication, but I do agree that it's really bad. I mean, and let me go work backwards here. Obama has blamed the deficit on Bush, and certainly he's right to blame most of the 2009 fiscal year deficit on Bush. And of course, the big increase in there, which of course Obama should take his share of blame for too, is the TARP money, $700 billion. And under federal budget rules, when they get $700 billion, it becomes part of the deficit that year. So when Obama says he's inherited this huge deficit, that's true. But given that $500 billion, there's only a net loss there of $200 billion so far, that should be taken into account too. And so what the TARP did, and this should have been anticipated by both Bush and Obama, and it's tragic, is the TARP put an additional baseline of $700 billion in the federal deficit, at least as I understand it. And one of the people who's written about this is Keith Hennessy, who was in the Bush administration, so you might think he's a biased observer, which I guess he is, but I think he's one of that rarest of creatures, an objective insider. And so, I think the tragedy that this, I mean, I was against the TARP from the get-go, and now here's an additional reason to be against the TARP. I think it was probably, other than the two wars, was one of Bush's worst legacies.
The president in his budget, though, is trying to recover about $90 billion of the $700 that went into the financial rescue with his fee on banks. How do you see that?
Well, I think that's unfair. I mean, the point is, if you want to recover money that you lent. Don't just have an additional tax. It'd be like saying, the government paid for part of my university education at UCLA, which it did, and it shouldn't have. But then, David Henderson, let's impose a higher tax on you for that reason. If I'd known that, I might not have taken the money. And by the way, there's an irony. Some of the banks wanted to refuse to take the money, but Paulson would not allow them to refuse.
What about the fact that the president's saying this budget will strengthen middle class, it will also provide investment in clean energy and infrastructure and create more jobs?
Well, there's a lot to handle in all that. I don't think it'll strengthen the middle class. I think it'll weaken the economy generally. And the middle class, of course, is such a big part of the economy that means they'll be weaker, all other things equal. Doesn't mean they won't be better off a few years from now, but that's because there are these underlying causes of growth, and this budget will weaken them, but not necessarily reverse growth and make it negative growth. I think the way to judge, and you know, economists who look at this generally think the way to judge whether an investment or an expenditure in clean energy is worth it is not to look at the jobs created, but to look at the benefits created. And a job is a cost. And so if you hear people saying, oh, this creates a million jobs, the translation is this means government, if it's a government expenditure, this means government is spending to employ a million people. Well, that means that million people cannot be employed elsewhere or are not employed elsewhere. And so there's a huge cost to that. So what I tell my students in the first day of class is that we've got to distinguish between creating jobs and creating wealth. Jobs in the private sector generally do create wealth because they represent the effect of a voluntary transaction between buyer and seller. Jobs in the government sector often destroy wealth because government is taxing people and using it for what they judge to be valuable things, but they might not be valuable at all.
Well, in the president's budget, there's, I mean, this may seem a small piece of it, but he's turning over, he's making, advocating less space exploration for NASA and turning things over as far as space operations to the private sector.
Yeah, and I haven't looked at that carefully, but just certainly on the face of it, that looks good.
Anything else look good to you, David?
Well, there were a few things. There's the extension of the relief from the alternative minimum tax. And let me just give a little history there. One of the last acts of the Johnson administration under a Secretary of the Treasury who lasted for a month, just the last month of the Johnson administration, Joseph Barr, was to impose what was called an alternative minimum tax. What they noticed was there are approximately 200 people, and I don't have that number wrong by more than about 50%, a very small number of people, who were high income and paying very little or paying no taxes. So instead of looking at what are the other causes behind that, what they did was they said, we're going to have this minimum tax so that if you are in that situation, you've got to pay some, according to some alternate tax scheme. Well, what happened is they didn't adjust all those brackets and so on for inflation. So we've roughly five-tupled the price level since then without adjusting those brackets much. And so what's happened is that a tax that was originally meant for a few hundred people, then a few thousand people, then 10,000 people, now without this extension of the relief would hit about 20 million taxpayers. And his budget, as far as I understand the Obama budget, it would make the relief from the AMT permanent. So that's one of the few good things I see in there.
Talking with economist David Henderson, and I want to open the phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join us with your thoughts about the president's $3.8 trillion budget for the fiscal year, which, by the way, begins October 1st and includes cutting spending on federal programs and raising $2 trillion in taxes and foresees a major health care overhaul. And we're talking about, obviously, how it affects California. If you'd like to join us with questions or comments, you're welcome to do so. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. We spoke earlier with Carolyn Lockhead, Washington correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle, and with us, in addition to David Henderson, is Gene Ross, executive director of the California Budget Project. Feel free to join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing on the Obama plan, the budget that has been proposed to Congress, which, by the way, hits record deficits under this plan and is a $3.8 trillion budget for the fiscal year, which would begin October the 1st and includes cutting spending on federal programs, raising $2 trillion in taxes, includes a spending freeze, and foresees major health care overhaul. We're looking at how the proposed budget also affects things here in California. Carolyn Lockhead was with us earlier, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle, and our guests include Gene Ross, the executive director of the California Budget Project, and David Henderson, who is research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Your calls are welcome. If you have questions or comments on the budget, it's toll-free to join us, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, and we'll go to your calls, and we'll begin with Jed. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so my comment is this. It seems to me that the problem we're having with our budget is that the things that the money is getting spent on are defined by very, very power corporate interests, the military-industrial complex, inefficient health care, things like that. And it's not that health care isn't important, but we spend, the United States spends more per person to regulate private health care than the Canadians spend per person to provide universal health care. Also, you look at our military budget, and we're spending over 50% of our budget goes directly to wars, past, present, and planned. Now, the British had to decide whether they were going to keep their empire, whether they were going to be a commonwealth and keep their budget. And at some point, the British decided to dismantle their empire, close down their foreign bases, and balance their budgets and prevent financial ruin. And we're at that same point where we can either keep all of these networks of massive bases everywhere and keep pouring tons of money into the military-industrial complex, or we can prevent the collapse of the dollar, which is what's going to happen if we keep borrowing 40% of our budget every year. And if the dollar collapses, we're really in a bad place. So I think it's time for our nation to reevaluate our priorities on what we're spending money on
and why we're spending the money. Let's hear from David Henderson.
Actually, Jed, I agree with a lot of what you said. I think you exaggerated the military budget. It's not really 50% of the budget. It's more like 25, but I think that's way too many percentage points too high. I'm actually an advocate of the defense budget being a defense budget, not an offense budget. And most of what the federal government spends now is either directly for wars against other countries that have never attacked us, or to be prepared for wars, as you point out, against other countries that are unlikely to attack us. And so I would like to see the U.S. government basically pull out of all the bases in the world, and I think we could cut the so-called defense budget, which really is an offense budget. I think we could cut it by approximately $500 billion a year.
Well, as I said earlier, this is the biggest Pentagon budget that we've seen.
Yes.
And Gene Ross, just getting back to California for a moment, there is enough in Governor Schwarzenegger's proposals that would perhaps end up sidestepping a good deal of the money that's supposed to come from the federal government. Is that not true?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
In other words, if we look at Governor Schwarzenegger's proposals, he could be perhaps, I think the word is sidestepping, but for lack of a better word, a large chunk of federal money that's supposed to be coming into the state.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the governor's proposed budget, the cuts that he would make in health programs, in social service programs, in programs for the elderly could cost California roughly $5 to $6 billion just in the health and services, health and human services areas alone, in order to make about $2 to $3 billion of state savings. So that's bad math. The impact on the California budget of those reductions would be tripled. And I'll disagree a little bit with David too. That is money that goes directly to job creation in the in-home supportive services program, for example, which is a program that sends caregivers into the homes of low-income elderly and disabled individuals. That is a virtually no overhead program. There's very little administrative structure to the program. And so virtually every dollar in the program goes to pay those caregivers, keep them working, get money that then gets spent in local communities. The money for health programs goes to hospitals, to doctors, to other medical care providers in local communities. So if you pull that money out of California, that's not good for our economy. That's going to boost our unemployment rate. So, yes, the governor, who has certainly talked a lot this year about how California isn't getting our fair share, quote unquote, of federal dollars, would leave a lot more money on the table under his proposed budget.
And again, Gene Ross is executive director of the California Budget Project. By the way, if you're trying to send comments to us, our comment line is down. You can send emails, forum@kqed.org. Normally, we ask you to post comments on our question online, but we're trying to remedy that at the present moment. And I ought to mention, by the way, David Henderson, As far as getting unemployment numbers down, the census is going to help at least for a while to get those numbers down, because a lot of people are going to be hired temporarily to do census work.
Yeah, I don't know what the number is. But I just want to point out, Jean didn't really disagree with me. She laid out that she thinks those jobs are worth it. And we can talk about that in other contexts. All I was saying is the way to judge these things shouldn't be by the number of jobs created, because that's a cost. It means people not doing something else.
Let's hear from more of our callers. And Ken joins us. Good morning, Ken.
Well, yes, thank you for taking my call. I took a little disagreement with David again. When you say people could be doing other jobs, if there are other jobs to do, that's the first thing. And then if they don't have other jobs to do, there are costs. There are big costs. There are both the social costs and there are financial costs. The second thing, every time the government does a project, now, for instance, a bridge is a cost. But what are the benefits to that cost? There are real economic benefits to the cost of a bridge. It saves people driving time. It saves gas. It keeps the environment cleaner. It also puts people to work, and it makes businesses more efficient. When you start adding up all of those costs compared to the cost of building the bridge and employee, you find you have a multiplier of effect of at least two or three times.
Well, Ken, your argument would apply also to a lot of the green energy projects, would it not?
Absolutely. The government now, in Obama's plan, which I think is disgusting, is throwing $45 billion into nuclear energy. If nuclear energy is such a great deal, why can't it pay for itself?
Well, you know what? Ken's exactly right on the last point, which is why I would challenge him on the earlier point. If these things are such a great deal, why can't they pay for themselves? And I would just point out that a jobs program or a program to do X, when they hire people to do X, whatever X is, even if you favor X, it's going to use labor that could have been used elsewhere. Ken says, oh, but a lot of those people were unemployed. Some of those people were unemployed. But if you build certain things and you're going to hire people, you aren't typically going to hire mainly from the ranks of the unemployed. You're going to typically hire from the ranks of the employed. And that means there is that serious loss of what those people could have done. And again, I think Ken didn't distinguish, and it's a distinction I try to make very clear, between whether you judge a program by its benefits or whether you judge it by whether it creates jobs.
Let me thank Ken for the call. And Jean Ross, you want in here?
I think this is an incredibly important debate that we're having here, and it does get to the role of what do we do better together? When can the public sector make investments that the private sector wouldn't be likely to make, bridges, roads, some of those things that we all take advantage of and don't always think
about. Excuse me, let's not forget high-speed rail, because that's in the package as far
as
California.
Oh, I want to address that.
and what jobs are being created? And right now, if you look at some of the infrastructure dollars that came out, will be spent over the next year, over the next 2 years from the economic recovery bill last year. One of the sectors that has really taken on the shorts in the recent downturn is construction. So there are a lot of construction workers who are without work. In this down economy, there are a lot of people across the economy. And the difference between where some of these federal dollars, and I think there has been a very precise attempt to carefully target those dollars. Those are dollars that will be spent in states, in local communities, where that private sector investment can occur overseas, if that's where the businesses feel they're likely to make the highest rate of return, whereas those healthcare dollars, the dollars to weatherize homes, dollars that flow through state budgets will be spent here in California. And that's the critical point.
But I think the problem with that, Gene,
David Henderson.
Yeah. I think the problem with that, Gene, is that if you go in that direction, you could easily justify not letting Californians spend any money outside California. And if that's so good, don't let people in Monterey spend any money outside of Monterey. And if that's so good, don't let anyone spend anything, but have everyone be self-sufficient, and a whole lot of us would starve. I mean, I think what you're leaving out is the huge gains from exchange, not just across from city to city, but across state lines and across international lines.
Let's bring on more callers. And Sybil, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. I find it very distracting that many people continue to refer to Social Security as an entitlement program, when in point of fact, it's a social insurance program. People pay a premium. I started paying when I had my first job at the age of 14, and a certain amount of money was paid as a premium for this insurance, which I would be able to take out when I reached a certain age. And it's true that people making over 80,000 or whatever that particular cutoff is, don't pay a proportion beyond that, which I don't think is correct. But it's certainly not correct to call it an entitlement when we've been paying premiums into this insurance program. And the amount of money that we get is based on the number of years we do that. If we have a 0 year, that's factored into the amount that we eventually get paid out as our insurance.
Well, actually, can I...
David Henderson, yeah.
Sybil, I half agree with you. I've never liked the term entitlement, but for a somewhat different reason. Just a little history here. The person who I understand, I was in the Reagan administration early in the 80s, the person who I think introduced that term, ironically, was David Stockman, who was trying to cut those programs. The problem I have is it makes it sound like you're entitled to it, and I don't see why you're entitled to it. The problem I have, although I think you accurately depicted how the Social Security benefit formula is set up, the problem I have is it's not social insurance either. It's really a tax and transfer scheme. It's not really insurance. It's not rated according to risk, and there are all kinds of internal transfers of wealth from black men to white men, and so on, from smokers to non-smokers because of differences in life expectancy, and just a lot of messing around with redistribution of wealth in that program.
Well, what's called entitlements, Gene Ross, when you look at the California budget, also makes it very difficult for California to move forward in terms of fiscal responsibility or getting its deficits out of the way. I mean, this remains sort of the elephant in the room for both of these budgets. It's just a microcosm here for what's going on the Fed level.
And again, I think if you look at the federal budget, the term entitlement really is sort of a wonky term that is used to distinguish what gets annually funded, what programs essentially move through the state budget. It's a little bit different. I think, again, Social Security is a social insurance program. I think the caller is right there. I think where she may not be entirely right is we do not pay, most of us don't fully pay into the program what we will get back in benefits. There is a generational transfer. It is not like a typical insurance program in that regard. But certainly, and again, I want to go back to what I said earlier about the importance of health reform. A lot of economists will say that the federal deficit problem really is a health reform problem. And I think it is good and appropriate that the president continued to put that line. I'm looking at the tables here, health insurance reform in the schedules where they score what goes into the bottom line of the federal budget. And I think that is our best hope going forward to both make sure that Americans get the health care they need, but also to begin reining in costs, to begin to whittle away at the number of people who don't have health coverage, but to make sure that the care for those individuals is paid for, to begin to rein in some of the drivers of costs that really will push deficits much larger in the future if we don't begin to get those costs under control.
Let me go to some listener emails, some opinions that I wanted to bring to your attention that listeners are bringing to our attention here, as well as some questions for each of our guests. This is from Jason, who says, the whole growth-based worldview is not a functional way of looking at the world anymore. We have created a new structural system without any need for the middle class. We now have a permanent third-world economy created by 30 years of short-sighted Wall Street-based offshoring of every middle-class job. Here's David, who says, I'm proud of President Obama for canceling the Return to the Moon program. It was irresponsible for Bush to sponsor such a fiscally irresponsible program, especially after Bush doubled the national debt by $5 trillion. We've already been to the moon, and it's a waste of money to go back. Let's explore space with much more economical unmanned probes and telescopes. And another listener, Cannoli, writes, has the recent Supreme Court decision put the last nail in the coffin for any kind of tax increases? With oil company profits at an all-time high, it's ironic that we are now hearing on this program that there is no chance for ending tax breaks to these corporations. It's amazing to hear the Democrats are joining the chorus to sustain tax breaks for the wealthy. How will any budget get balanced without increased tax revenues? Families have had to increase family revenues with multiple jobs. Students in California have seen university fees go up 40%. All of us are paying additional fees for all government services. When are those to whom we have entrusted government going to acknowledge that costs go up as time goes on and revenue taxes are going to have to follow? Peggy from Palo Alto says, I'm always hearing that government needs to act just like a family in hard times, sit down and figure out how to get by on less. When will this advice be given to the Pentagon? Why don't they have to take a hard look at where they can cut the fat from their budget, just like hardworking families? And a question for you, Gene Ross, from a listener, Minu, who says, is hoping if you could ask or have Gene Ross maybe opine on what the downstream effect of the Obama budget may be on the UC and CSU systems.
One of the aspects of the recovery package that was not extended in the president's budget is the funding stream that does flow through to schools. We would hope that, Congress will take a look, potentially put some money into the state fiscal stabilization block grant, some of the other monies that have been used to, mitigate the impact of some of the state reductions in both K-12 and higher education budgets. If we go back to the what's been driving the deficit, it's critical to realize that the fact is that the Bush tax cuts, the unfunded Bush tax cuts, are responsible, along with defense spending, for a very, very large share of the deficit. I think certainly the president was correct in allowing the tax cuts on the highest income Americans to expire. We, again, if you believe, and I think there's some critical timing questions about how much do you want to slow the deficit in the near term until we're convinced that the economy is on the road to recovery. And again, going back to, David and my debate on where we create jobs, I think if your goal is to create jobs in America, in California, how you target resources is very important. And I think that certainly is one of the president's goals here, is to begin to ramp down unemployment. I think that's all of our goals. We want jobs here at home. And I think one to the writer's point, I think one of the most interesting things in the budget is that the president is beginning to, try to get a handle on people who are corporations that are not paying all of the taxes they owe, and to begin to trim back on some obsolete tax breaks. I hope that those make it through to the final budget. I think there's some good, as I said earlier, there for California in beginning to look at how we administer our tax system and making sure that, everybody pays the taxes they owe before we ask anybody to pay more.
And again, Gene Ross is Executive Director of the California Budget Project. David Henderson is Research Fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford and Associate Professor of Economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And David Henderson, here's a listener who writes, well, I have a listener who makes a comment and another who makes a question, and I'll just wed them together here for you. Mike from Nicosia says, David's simplistic comment that we should not look at green industry benefits so much as creating jobs through government spending as it will create wealth. Which is more important, pure wealth or full unemployment? Or full employment, excuse me. Further, if you carry David's reasoning further, why not get rid of all government employment and just have private industry making wealth for CEOs and stockholders? And then Ben writes, I'm interested in David Henderson's thoughts on the volatility of tax revenue as a percentage of GDP, which he explained was due to it being an income-based revenue collection scheme, and whether a different collection scheme, example the fair tax or a VAT, which are different, would provide less volatility.
I'd like to address those, but I'd like to reach back just quickly on, some of the other emails you had. Although I'm a big fan of Carolyn Lockhead's reporting on Washington, I think she's one of the best, she used a term, and one of the questioners who emailed in used a term that I think really needs to be challenged, and that is that these are tax cuts or tax increases on the wealthy. And they aren't. They're tax cuts or tax increases for high-income people. And there's a huge difference between income and wealth. Wealth means your net worth. Income is what you made that year. And you can have someone who's relatively high income but low wealth. You can have someone, especially elderly people, who are low income but high wealth.
So I just think that's a real misuse of language that needs to be corrected. I also want to point out that the Supreme Court decision basically just affirmed freedom of speech, and it didn't, as Obama said in his State of the Union last week, overturn 100 years of law. It turned it down. It overturned parts of an 8-year-old law that Bush signed and shouldn't have signed because he knew it was unconstitutional, and parts of and a ruling of 1990. And the point is, really, freedom of speech is important no matter who has it, and I just think that's important. Okay. To the question about, I think it was about green jobs.
Yeah.
The point I'm making is that it's really important to distinguish the way every high school kid does between the job, which is a cost, and the benefit that's created. So let's say I'm a high school kid trying to make money to buy a car, and I mow lawns to do that. I generate value for the people I do it for, or they wouldn't have paid me. No high school kid kids himself that an additional benefit of his creating that wealth is that he got to work. If he could have pushed a button and gotten the same benefit, he would have done so. And in fact, the history of economic growth is the history of doing more and more with less and less.
Excuse me, David Henderson, I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, and we're talking to David Henderson and Gene Ross about the federal budget, and also this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, David, please continue your thoughts.
With less and less. And so, I mean, if we had tried to keep telephone operators and not use fiber optics and not use computers and mechanization, we might not have Starbucks because the people freed up from that are able to work in Starbucks.
You also had a question from a listener about volatility. And
all right. Yeah, I think the volatility issue is a big one, and I think that the problem is that the Clinton administration, when it was forecasting surpluses as far as the eye could see, and by the way, I want to give due credit to Clinton and the Republican Congress. I think they were together. They did a lot to get the federal budget and the deficit under control.
Under control? But, we didn't have any deficits.
Well, in the last 2 years of the administration. But they projected those surpluses forward. It's true that Bush did pretty much everything wrong as far as what he did about those surpluses, but it's also true that the administration's projections were inaccurate, and because they assumed the same kinds of capital gains tax revenue that they'd been reaping in the late 90s with com boom. So when the boom went bust, that wasn't going to happen. So I think there is volatility. I think the volatility, by the way, in tax revenues is a bigger problem in the California system than it is in the federal.
I was just going to ask Gene Ross about that. I think you're right. And Gene, you want to opine on that?
Again, I think we're moving a little bit of off topic here, but I think volatility, it can be our friend. It can be a very good thing if you have been making a consistent amount of money over time, and all of a sudden you get a big bonus 1 year. That's a good thing. It's what you do with those additional revenues that really matters. And again, I think at the end of the Clinton years, we did move at the federal level to surplus. I think it really is, how do you manage volatility? What do you do with those funds? Do you commit them to ongoing spending versus maybe putting a little bit in the bank if you, inherit some money 1 year and you save some of that for your retirement, for your children's education? That's certainly a good thing. I think a lot of the people who talk about reducing volatility in our tax systems, both at the state level and the federal system, it's really a smokescreen for shifting taxes from investment income to income from work, from high-income individuals to middle-income individuals. And I think it certainly sounds perhaps more politically acceptable to say we want to reduce volatility. The reality is it's a hidden agenda of shifting who pays taxes and how much money is available for public spending. I think it's probably clear to your listeners that David and I have a different view for the role of public systems and structures in our economy. We look at who invests a little bit differently, and I think that's why we have a different view of taxation and who ought to pay taxes in our economy.
Well, I didn't use any smokescreen at all, Gene. I said what I thought. In fact, I would like everyone to pay less tax. And the fact is, the problem with volatility, I mean, you're right, that if somehow the state government would hold on to those revenues during high revenue years and use them as a rainy day fund, that would be great. They don't do that. And we've got lots of evidence they don't do that. And I just think we shouldn't kid ourselves that they will.
Let me get another caller on here. And Daniel, thank you for waiting. Join us. Good morning.
Hi, how are you doing? I had a couple comments. I've been listening to the show, and I find myself laughing when people are throwing around a number like a billion or a trillion. I can't even wrap my mind around that kind of money. And also, is there really still a middle class to even speak of? And when it comes to the smoke screens or the misuse of language, I kind of look at it this way. I'm disabled. I get $631 a month. And I hear about people getting a $500,000 bonus. And I think those people are the ones who should be taxed. I think the oil companies should be taxed, and I think pharmaceutical companies should pay a lot more tax. But in all reality, what they call the lobbyists are just the people who are paying under the table to get people into different Senate seats. So why can't people just be upfront about that and stop using all these fun little terms?
Hi, Daniel. I appreciate your call and your strong opinions. Thank you for that. Anybody want to comment in response?
Yeah, David, I think to get your arms around a trillion, it would be to divide a trillion by approximately 300 million people, and that would be approximately $3,300 per person. So what I find is when I talk about these numbers with audiences and Rotary clubs and so on, I try to put it on a per-person basis, because I agree, a trillion just seems like some abstraction. So I do think we need to do things like put it on a per-person basis.
Well, this has been not an illuminating hour, but there have been a couple of very good debates here. Like Gene Ross says, we got off on volatility, but I think it was fascinating. And I want to thank both of you for your involvement in the program. Gene Ross, again, is executive director of the California Budget Project, and David Henderson is a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. We also spoke with Carolyn Lockhead earlier, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. And we thank you, our listeners, for being with us this hour. Wouldn't be here without you. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Want to also thank senior editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.